you. This is the first time in this institute, and I'm very, very impressed. My talk is presumably going to be mathematical, but I don't think this should be an issue. My experience with the practitioner in finance is that not only they are very sophisticated mathematically, but they're very aggressive, and when they want to pay attention to something, they're not bothered by mathematical technicalities. So what I'm going to try to discuss today is a problem which I found quite amusing from a mathematical point of view, and for which, unfortunately, I couldn't find much literature on when I started working on it. And this is the problem of American option. I'm just testing if this... Okay. I'm in an engineering school, but I don't even know how to use these little gadgets, so I'll skip that. So what I'm going to do is that review very fast what a typical American option is and what are the typical mathematics involved in the analysis of American option. And this is to throw at you the notation, the terminology, which the mathematician and the probabilist mostly use to analyze these subjects. And what I want to do is possibly with some motivation from some practical instrument which people are trading or using regularly, introduce American option with several exercises, try to illustrate how important they can be, and try to also show how interesting the mathematics is when you try to analyze these subjects. So typically, when we have an American option, and this slide is written, the first three slides are written for discrete time. So what we have is that we have an adapted process, which you think of it as the reward process. If I exercise the options at time n, I'll get the reward, which is given by xn. And what is important is to have a notion of history, the filtration of the events which are known at each time n, and have a set of stopping rule, which are, in this case, exercise rule. The purpose of the exercise is to stop the game at a time tau, which is going to be a random time, a stopping time, in such a way that the expected reward is maximized. Okay? So the three typical problems are, what is the value of this supremum? Sometimes this is called the value function of the problem. Sometimes it's called the reduit of the function, at least by the French. And this is the first problem. The second problem is that, you know, can we find a policy, stopping rule attaining the maximum? And also, can we characterize this optimal policy? If there is one, I would like to know it, may be able to use it. Okay? So, like most mathematicians, what you do when you have a problem is you put the conclusion of the problem inside the problem and you believe, you convince yourself that you solved the problem. So the solution of this problem is actually the statement of the problem. You define a new process, which is going to be the supremum in question, but where the expectation is replaced by a conditional expectation. In other words, the difference between the previous slide and this one is the fact that there is a conditional expectation. So what you do is that you look at time n, if I were to choose optimally the time of exercise, what would I get? I get something which I call xn hat, and which the probabilists call the Snell envelope. This new process, it's a process because it involves the conditioning with respect to the information up to time n, coincide with the original process at the end, so that's not bad. It satisfies the dynamic programming principle. This is the second bullet point. And what makes probabilists happy is that this is the smallest super martingale majorizing the original reward process. So I put the solution of the problem inside the problem itself. I didn't resolve it. I didn't solve anything. But I got a lot of information from what the solution should look like. It has to have these three properties. And so the solution to the optimal stopping problem, and you know, typically pricing an American option is solving an optimal stopping problem, is given by this process at the beginning. But if we continue to analyze this process a little bit further, one realized that a stopping time is optimal if and only if it has these two properties, namely the original process and the Snell envelope coincide. So at the time of an optimal exercise, they have to coincide. And before this time of exercise, the process has to be a martingale. Okay, so that's something which is remarkable, and this is what is going to be used to construct optimal stopping time. And the minimal optimal stopping time is obtained because of this as the first time that the two coincide. Again, you know, this is clean mathematics, but that doesn't tell you anything how to behave in a practical situation. Okay, so what I want to do is consider the same mathematical problem when we have several exercises possible. Okay. And so these type of contract, these types of gadget exist. They're ubiquitous in the energy sectors. I came to this problem by working in the energy sectors, and they're all over the place. The last time I discovered that was in a conversation with one of my brothers in France, where he told me that the National Electric Utility in France used basically to force on customers this sort of contract where the company could 60 times in a year choose one day where they would change the rate. Of course, they would give some perks to the customer to accept this contract, but in the contract they were written explicitly that the EDF was allowed 60 times during the year to basically jerk up the rate at their will. Okay. So this company, EDF, was giving itself the right to exercise 60 times whatever option they had within a year. So this is typical of these contracts with multiple exercise. They're usually called take or pay, and a simple form of them is sometimes called swing contract. But they occur in many different other instances. Most of the executive option programs involve reloading of options. In other words, you exercise and then you're given more options. So they have a feature where you choose the optimal time to exercise your option. You have some constraint, and I'll come back to this constraint in a minute, but you have many options to exercise. Not only one exercise and that's it, you refill your basket of options as you go along. Purchase of an airplane. You know, when Korean Line announces that they buy 50 Airbuses, they don't buy 50 Airbuses. They take an option to five times over the next 10 years, they can purchase at the time of their choosing 10 of these Airbuses. So this is again an American option which they can exercise five times over the next 10 years. And there are examples in the fixed incomes as well. So the challenges now are, how do we value these options with multiple exercise, and how do we compute the optimal policy? When I started looking at this, I think 2 or 3 years ago, I couldn't find any literature except one paper that I will mention in a few minutes. And if people know all the paper on this topic, I would like to know. So the simple discrete time mathematical problem which I had before can be generalized now in this way. We still have the same setup. We still have, as before, you know, filtration of the event available, the conditional expectation, et cetera, et cetera. But now we choose an integer p, which is going to be the number of time we allow to exercise the American type options. But what we're looking for now is a set of p stopping times, so p times of exercises, and I order them in a different way, in the reverse order. And what I'm trying to optimize now is the expected reward, the reward being given by the sum of all the exercises, the p exercises. Of course, you know, you can make this more sophisticated formulation of a problem, but at least mathematically, this is a simple example where the reward is additive. Okay? So, question as before, what is the value of the supremum? Is the supremum attained? And then can I set up an algorithm to compute an optimal strategy? So I'm going to give you the solution to this problem. It's exactly at the same level of abstraction as the previous one, so it's totally impractical. But at least it gives you the natural way to attack this problem. And I want to do that because this is definitely not the way I want to attack it myself. But at least, you know, I think this is a natural way to do it. In the same way I solved the problem before, if I have my reward process Xn here, I'm going to define the first reward process as Xn itself. I compute you see the hat here means that I'm computing the Snell envelope. So the process Y1 is my expected reward if I exercise one write optimally. So then I define inductively the second reward process. And the way this is defined is that this is the reward that I will get if I exercise one write at time n, plus from this point on, the reward that I would get by exercising another write optimally after that. Okay? So because I have conditional expectation with respect to n, and because this is the optimal reward for one exercise, this represents exactly the process where I exercise one exercise at time n, and maybe not optimally, but the next one being optimal. Okay? And so you can define inductively these new reward process and the corresponding Snell's envelope. Okay? And typically, you define the last one, the reward process with my P exercise used up will be at time n, this will be the reward that I get by exercising one of my P exercise. And once I'm done, after that, I exercise optimally the P minus one remaining exercise, right? Okay. So in this way, I reduce the P exercise problem into a hierarchy of P embedded one exercise problem. Okay. The reward function being different at each time. So it's clear that whatever I can do for one, I can do it for P by this inductive argument. Okay. So by this recursive rewriting of the P exercises, I reduce everything to solving at each given time one exercise problem, the classical American option, but now the reward being different. Okay, so you can ignore this technical result. But now, with this notation, you know, the maximum expected reward is given by the pth Snell envelope at time zero. And if we define stopping time in this form, we have a set of optimal stopping time. Again, from a mathematical point of view, I'm done. From a practical point of view, I've done basically nothing, except that I've conceptualized the fact that P exercise could be attacked in an inductive manner. And if I, you know, am smart enough to handle the tool involving the solution of one American exercise, I should be able to exercise to solve the full problem. If I have n American options, and if the time is optimal, I'm going to exercise them at the same time.
So what changes when you exercise?
But I cannot exercise them at the same time. In fact, in practice, you know, in practice, you have a refraction period. In other words, for the swing options, if I decide to exercise one of my right, basically for 1 week after that, I cannot exercise the next one. So in the discrete time case, I'm just assuming that the times are different. I really want P exercises, okay? But they have to be different. There was strict inequality between them. In the continuous time, you're going to see that I'm going to have to do something. If not, I will exercise my right at the same time, okay? So in the continuous case, for two different reasons, for the fact that the problem would become trivial because I will use all my rights at the same time. And because, as I said, in practice, you know, for the swing option in the energy industry, those that I've seen, if you exercise once, you have to wait on the sideline for a certain period of time. So there's this refraction period. So for these two reasons, the statement of the problem will be a little bit different in the continuous case. And the continuous case is the case that I'm going to study first. I'll come back at the end with a very practical construction, which will involve, of course, the discrete time and the discrete value case. But the continuous case, for a probabilist, the way to look at an American option problem is to look at the classical optimal stopping problem. And there are books, like the book of Shiri Ayef. There is a course taught by Nicole El-Khaoui at Saint-Flour, which is extremely detailed, extremely exhaustive treatment of the subject, but which is totally unreadable. And this has been rewritten both in English and in clearer mathematics with the Karatsev and Shriv. Nicole is a very good friend of mine, so I can't afford to say that. And I think she's finally decided to have a student rewrite this set of lecture notes from Saint-Flour. And so that will be welcome. So what is existing in the multiple optimal stopping problem? As I said, when I started looking at it, I could find only this paper of Thompson, but which has nothing specific in it, but something extremely specific, which was an algorithm of Jaye, Ron, and Tompidis, who basically implemented on a tree, transforming a tree into a forest, and implemented this inductive procedure. They implemented the dynamic programming procedure in this inductive way to look at the problem, where you look at the number of writes which are left, and you decrease this number of writes from P to zero. And then there was a paper by Ibanez, which I had never seen, but he told me that he was writing something, which was basically a survey of several numerical methods. So I started looking at this problem, and I worked with Nizar Tuzi on the case of the Brownian motion, or the Black-Scholl case, and with Savash Dayanik, a student of Karatsev, and I'm going to basically discuss some of these results. And then I'll switch to interesting numerical result. Interesting because I think for me they allowed me to use things that I learned years and years ago, and I cannot believe that they could be useful in a very practical situation, because I thought I learned pure mathematics at that time. But I have to mention something that I discovered very recently. There is not a D here, but Ben Hambly and a couple of people at Oxford have implemented, in the case of multiple exercise, the computation of bounds, which were proposed by Chris Rogers for the price of an American option. But again, so they can handle this this situation, except that they will not be able to handle the refraction time, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Can I still try this? No. All right. Okay, so here is the mathematical setups that most that a good part of financial mathematics is dealing with. This is the framework proposed by Samuelson and used by Black and Scholl to derive the formula. So what we have is that we have a real-valued Brownian motion, so that's going to be our WT, and we're going to consider, to avoid the trivial cases, the case of an American put. So we're going to look at an American put. So this is the payoff, this function phi of x is the payoff of the American put, and the actual payoff process is the value of the payoff function, the American put, over this geometric Brownian motion, which has an explicit form in the case of the Black-Scholl model. Okay, so if I'm assuming that I have p writes to exercise my American type option, what I'm going to call the value function, which was the iterated Snell envelope, is going to be this baby here. In other words, this is the supremum over all the possible choice of stopping times tau 1, tau p, so I want p times at which I'm going to exercise, of the expected reward, and I use the discounting e to the minus rt to bring this value back to time t equals 0. Okay? But now, to address the question of Robert, these stopping times, I'm going to demand that they are separated by a fixed amount of time. So I'm going to choose a number delta positive, 1 week, and if I exercise once, so if I choose a stopping time tau, the next one will have to be at least tau plus delta. Okay? So this little constraint here, I repeat, is there for two reasons: to make the problem realistic, because it corresponds to something which is imposed in the indenture of the contract. And second, because in the continuous time, all my stopping time would collapse to the same value if not. Okay? To the exercise of the classical American option. Okay. So what I'm going to do is that instead of looking at the real interesting problem with the finite horizon, when I buy an American option, I have a maturity, which is finite. It's not a perpetual option. But as a mathematician, it's easier to work with a perpetual option. So I'm going to pretend that I didn't hear that there was a maturity, or I'm going to basically state it, and I'm going to study this problem. So this is a simple review of the solution of the problem where you have one right. So this is a classical American option, and for an American put, and you can exercise it any time from now to the end of time. Okay? So this is not realistic in this sense, but then the solution is explicit, and the Snell envelope, this abstract Snell envelope that I was talking about, can be constructed explicitly, and we can see how they look. How do they look? It's on this slide. Okay, the actual value function is given by something which looks a little bit like the payoff. It's k minus, x when x is small, smaller than this little number x1, and if not, it's something else. Okay, so there is a number x1, which is smaller than the strike. So I don't know if you can see, but if I plot the payoff of the option, so this is k. If I plot the payoff of the... Tom is going to hate me by the end of the evening by switching back and forth. Okay, so this is the payoff. In other words, if the stock is a value larger than k, and if I exercise it, I won't get anything. If the stock is value is small, then I can and if I do exercise, whatever I get is this payoff. If x is here, this is my payoff. Okay? So what we have is that the value function, if there is a certain number x1 star, such that the value function coincides with the payoff and then goes its own way. Okay? And if you remember what I said before, is that in this very abstract theory, the minimal exercise time, optimal time, the minimal exercise time can be obtained by the first time the two coincide. The value function and the payoff, the reward, coincide. So this is exactly what's happening here. The value function coincide with the payoff over a certain interval, okay, when x is smaller than this number x1 star. So what is happening is that I let my stock move around. Whenever the stock crosses x1 star from the right, I exercise. If I were already in this, I exercise immediately. So I have partitioned the space, the possible value of my stock, into two intervals. This interval between 0 and x1 star, and x1 star is infinity. Whenever the underlying is in this region, I don't do anything, I don't exercise, I wait. Remember, this is a perpetual option, so I can wait as long as I want. And whenever the stock gets in there, hits this point, I do exercise. This is the solution of the perpetual option. Okay? And so everything rides on computing this number x1 star, which is the threshold. And you can think of this as the exercise boundary. Okay? So when the process hits this boundary, bing, you exercise. So what is going on with the perpetual swing options? As I said before, I can always set it up in the inductive fashion that I did before, and if I write it in terms of these expectations over the Black-Scholes model, this is what I get here. Okay, so I have a value function vk, so for each k, so I have v0, v1, v2, up to vp, okay, and you notice that there is this little number delta, which is going to be a pain in the rear, and what you have is that you have exactly what I said before, except for the fact that now I have to look at the payoff, a reward function, which is, this is the reward if I were to exercise immediately, if I were to exercise one right, and then this is the reward if I exercise optimally k minus one right, but I have to start delta units of time later. And this is messing up the analysis quite a bit. Okay? But this is exactly the strategy that I defined before. It's written in this complicated notation here, but this is exactly what I said before. Okay? I want to look at now, in a sense, an option where when I exercise, I get the payoff of one exercise plus the optimal payoff if I were to exercise the k minus one remaining right from this point on, except for the fact that I have to wait a unit of time delta before starting exercising. So you can write these value functions or solution of HJB equations. I am sure that some clever PDE people would be able to solve these equations. I don't think I can handle this hierarchy, because now we have a hierarchy of P equations. I don't know that I can handle that. And in any case, I feel uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, you have to, when you have the solution of this HJB equation, have some sort of a verification theorem whose assumptions are usually very difficult to check. Okay, what is not difficult to prove, at least in this setup, is that we can find numbers xk star, we can find numbers xk star, they're above the threshold of the one exercise, so this looks good, and the value function is equal to the payoff function on this interval. So this is really good, because now if I define this optimal time here, this stopping time here, these are exactly the optimal time that I was talking about in this abstract setting. Now I have them concretely. If I can get a hold of these numbers x star, oops, what have I done? If I can get a hold of this number xk star, I have the stopping time. Okay. So in other words, I let the price go its own way. The first time it hits x star p, bam, I exercise one right. I wait delta unit of time. I don't have the right to exercise. And after that, I look at the first time it hits x star p minus 1, and I exercise my second right, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the solution that we can show exist. What is interesting is that these numbers are ordered. These numbers are ordered. In other words, you have x1 star smaller than x2 star, smaller than x3 star, etc. This should be obvious. This should be obvious. The reason why it is so difficult to prove mathematically is because of this delta unit of time. Because between, for 1 week, I'm going to let my process go wherever the process wants to go. The price is going to go up. The price is going to go down. When I'm going to start looking for my next exercise, Lord knows what the price is going to be, very high, very low. So there may not be obvious reason why these thresholds had to be ordered. Nevertheless, in the case of the Black-Scholes model, we can prove that they're ordered, and this is a pathetic plot of the first 250 one of them. So you see that it's growing, and it seems that it becomes very flat very fast. And indeed, these thresholds converge to a number x star infinity, which is strictly smaller than k. What this means is that even if you have infinitely many rights to exercise, you do not exercise them as soon as the option is in the money. You have to wait a little bit. And this is this competition between the discount rate, the interest rate, and the delta. This is a plot of this limit threshold. So this is a analysis exercise on the Black-Scholes model, the Black-Scholes formula, and this inductive stuff. You can rewrite the same thing in the more general setting for any linear diffusion, any one-dimensional diffusion. And a certain number have been used, Brownian motion, on-channel Lembeck geometric, Brownian motion, geometric mean reverting process used by these people at, I think they're at USC. No. They're not too far. The main point of this slide is that except in this very particular case, I have no idea how to prove that these thresholds are ordered. In other words, in all these cases, we can show that there are points at which you have to giving optimal exercises for this multiple American option. In other words, you let the underlying process move along. Each time it hits one of them, you exercise one of your rights. We can even give construction using the idea of the thesis of this Dianic student of Karatsas. No way, I mean, we're not able to prove that these things are ordered. Okay. So I think this is quite a challenge, and the reason is the existence of this delta. What I want to tackle now for the rest of the talk is the realistic case of the option with the finite horizon. This was a mathematical exercise, you know, in which I had my entire life to decide to exercise this option, and I was not forfeiting any right by waiting. Now we have a finite horizon. So if I have P right to exercise and I get closer and closer to maturity, I'm going to be less and less demanding, and I'm going to try to burn my rights, because if not, they're going to go to waste. Okay? So the situation is very different. It is the same as in the classical case of the American option, except compounded. So in the case of Bermudan option, where you have a small grid of time at which you can implement the exercise, as I mentioned before, Ben Hamley and his collaborator have implemented the idea of Chris Rogers to find bounds. In the continuous case, again with this refraction period, which is typical in the energy market, it is possible to show existence of exercise boundary, but no idea where they are. Absolutely no idea where they are, and certainly not able to prove that they are ordered. Okay. So can we compute numerically? I was working with Nizar Tusi, and Nizar was a strong advocate of the use of the Malievan calculus in Monte Carlo computation in finance. And so he basically put a student of his on the job, and he developed Monte Carlo calculation of this exercise boundary. So this is a plot of the first value function. And so you look when the value function is equal to the payoff, and you get the first hitting time. I don't know if you can see this, but these are the exercise boundary, which we computed by computing the value functions and afterwards looking where they coincide. And this is by these three authors, Malievan, Monti, and Carlo. So the boundaries are, I mean, the first one looks reasonable. The first one should be basically the exercise of the exercise boundary for an American option. The other one are pretty jaggy, but they look very reasonable. They're one on top of each other, as we were expecting, never crossing as expected. These calculations are very heavy and very computer intensive, even though Malievan calculus for geometric Brownian motion is an oxymoron. I mean, you don't need Malievan calculus to do these calculations, but, you know, it looks good and it sounds good to talk about integration by parts for these sort of things. So this is time. This is time. These options have a 1 year maturity. And so, and this is the value of the stock. So I don't remember what was the unit, was the strike 100, presumably. This is what everybody thinks. So what you have is the following. Let's imagine then my underlying stock starts here. So I should exercise three options. The first time it hits here, I exercise the fourth, and the first time it hits here, I exercise the fifth one, and I'm done. In the case of the classical American option, you look at your stock running, and the first time it hits this exercise boundary, you exercise your option. And you see, the closer you get to maturity, the exercise region, the exercise boundary curved to get to the strike of the option, which I think is 100 in this calculation. Okay. Sorry. Delta is if this is a little delta, is the refraction time. Okay, the time that you cannot. Once you exercise once, you cannot exercise a second time.
And it looks like they're mostly constant delta in the top.
No, they have to convert. I mean, the to the strike. The first one is to convert to the strike. Well, possibly the spacing at the end. Possibly the spacing at the end, because when you get to, you know, five deltas, you didn't exercise anything. You're going to exercise your five right at the last minute. Okay. So my guess is that if I were to plot this properly, I would see the, you know, five intervals of length, little delta at the end. Because if I didn't exercise yet, I'm going to exercise now. If not, I lose it. So if for whatever reason, you know, the options are still in the money, I'm going to exercise them this way. So this is my guess, but I think that's exactly it. So what I want to do now is something fun for me. When I was looking at this computation, I was extremely unhappy. I decided to try to approach the numerical problem differently. And what I'm going to do is that I'm going to try to, at least in the case of a single American option, so not swing, not multiple exercise, try to sell you another method to compute the price of an American option and to compute the exercise boundary. I am not 100% sure that this is more efficient than what's existing now. But, you know, from a mathematical point of view, I think it's very appealing, so I'm happy with that, and I'll leave that to other people to optimize the code and get it better and get a better result. But the reason why I started working in this direction is not so much to find one more way to price an American option, but for the multiple exercise, if that works for one, the method that I'm going to use is going to work with the same level of complexity and the same computational burden will work for multiple exercise. Okay? So this is my claim, and I'm going to try to sell you this idea. I was going to use the board, but I think that because I'm running a little bit late, I'm going to still use my slide, even though I don't like that. So here is the deal. The price of the American option with finite horizon is given by this formula here. Okay, you look at the payoff F, you compute it at the time you decide to exercise. You discount by e to the minus r tau, the time to exercise. You compute this expected payoff, okay? And you try to find the optimal time giving you this payoff. Okay? And I repeat, you know, you can keep in mind the case of the American put. So what I want to do is rewrite here. I use this function e to the minus r tf of x, and I call it capital F. So I rewrite this in this form. I didn't do anything. I just introduce a new notation to write this in this way. Now what I'm doing is I'm writing this expectation as plainly an integral. This is the integral of this new function f, nothing special, with respect to a measure, which is now the measure is the distribution of the time at which I decide to stop and the value of the underlying stock at the time I stop. Okay? So now I have a distribution of possible values. You know, I'm just working in this plane, the plane time and stock values. Okay? In this plane, I have a distribution. Okay? This is the distribution of the time at which I decide to stop and the corresponding value of the stock at that time. So this, if I think of this as a function of this distribution, this is linear in this distribution. What is highly nonlinear is this baby here. Okay? So what I'm going to try to do is say, can I characterize by any chance the measure which can occur as time position or time value when I use a stopping rule. When I use a stopping rule, which is non-anticipative, which is only the information that I have in the past, so I don't have any crystal ball, if I choose one of these rules, what are the measures that I can get in this way? So what I'm going to try to do is replace this complicated stuff here, namely, for all the possible stopping time less or equal than my horizon t, the distribution of the time and the value, I'm going to try to characterize this. Okay? This was done in the 70s, so showing my age, when people were gung-ho about studying Markov processes. So in this slide, I state a theorem, okay? And this theorem I'm going to apply to a Markov process which I denoted x tilde t And the process extility that I'm going to use is the space-time process, where I look at time, one component, and value of the stock, second component. Okay? So this new process, space-time process, like we call it, will be the process I'm going to apply this result. And this result tells me that if I have a process starting, you know, from one given value, but it could be any measure, and if I try to consider a new probability measure mu, I have to use this potential of the Markov process, whatever that is, but this theorem tells me that there exists a stopping time tau such that the distribution of the process at this random time is mu, if and only if I have an inequality of this time. This is the potential applied to this measure, and this is the potential applied to the initial distribution. So this is totally known. My right-hand side is totally known. But this looks very much like linear constraint. If I'm trying to use this measure mu as my new variable, what I did in the previous slide is write the objective function as a linear function of mu, and now I have this enormous set of constraints is now written as a set of linear constraints. Okay. Now, there is a little catch, is that this theorem works only for randomized time. Okay? In other words, you have to add an extra source of randomness if it's not already there. Take that. Believe me, this does not change the value function. The value function, you know, it's just a trivial mathematical fact. It doesn't change the value function. I can allow myself to use randomized time. I'm not going to do better. I'm not going to do worse. So the optimal is the same. Okay? This is a trivial mathematical fact. So now I have rewritten my problem exactly like a linear program. Okay? I want to compute the supremum of a linear function over these measures and the constraint. And, you know, I have measures that are positive and satisfy this inequality. So what have I gained, what have I lost? The fact that I'm working with a finite horizon, which is, in the other approaches, a pain, it's trivial here. This simply means that my measure is going to be... This simply means that my measure is going to be supported in the space-time in this interval 0t cross r instead of being on the whole half-line. So this is no problem. So if I want really to do calculation, this is nice and dandy to have an abstract linear program stated mathematically, but if I want to do real calculation, I'm going to discretize time, okay? So I'm going to discretize time, and I'm going to discretize also space, because as I said, you know, I want to put stuff in my computer, okay? And now a measure on this space-time becomes a vector where mu and I, mu is basically the distribution of the process when I stop at time n, and I is the probability, will give me the probability that at that time the stock has the value coded by I. In this way, you know, the value function, the value of the American option becomes a plain value of a linear program. Okay? I have a matrix, the matrix G, this potential matrix, which I didn't tell you what it is, but, you know, it's a matrix, multiplied by this big, gigantic vector. I have positivity constraint, I have this inequality, and I have this thing over there. Okay. And the objective function, which is simply the integral of f with respect to the measure mu, which I write in this form here. Okay. Now, the reason why I'm after this approach is also because I have a dream. And this dream is that if I solve this linear program and I look at the argument, because, you know, any program, any simplest method or any method that I'm going to use is going to give me at least one measure mu at which the optimum is attained. I would like to look at the support of this measure mu, because I have the sneaky feeling that the support of this measure mu is not going to depend upon the initial value of the stock, first, and second, it may give me the exercise boundary. Okay? And as I'll point out in a minute, it actually does. Okay? So the problem here is that this is too big a linear program. But, you know, I live in now in an engineering school after living in a math department for my entire life, and people tell me, well, you know, we have been consulting for companies, we have been spending 10 years optimizing code, and if your matrix, the matrix giving the constraint is sparse, you can handle any problem you want. If you need, you'll have to go to an interior point method. You may not implement the simplex method, but, you know, as long as your matrix is sparse, you're in business. This, in general, this potential matrix is not sparse, but in the case of space-time processes, like I tell you here, you can rewrite this constraint. You have to add a few more extra variables, but you can write this constraint in such a way that this matrix G changes into a new matrix, but which is sparse. So we did a certain number of calculations to test this method. So this is an option which is a 1 year strike 100. And this is the support of the measure. And this is basically, so the discretization we used is a trinomial tree approximating the Black-Scholes model with a certain number of parameters, which I forgot. But this is exactly the exercise boundary that you would get and that you find in books if you want to exercise. It is not very pretty because there is a discretization in space. And indeed, if you zoom in, so this is zooming in, you see that you have this plateau, but you know, this is because I discretize in space, okay? And this is another run which shows you that it's a little bit smoother and which shows you that, you know, it really, really captures the exercise boundary computed with using a PDE method with the free boundary problem. So the bottom line is that as I said before, this at this stage is presumably not competitive with the most efficient ways to compute the exercise boundary. But what I've done here is that I solve the problem of the price of an American option for one starting point, and I have the exercise boundary. Usually, in numerical method, you have to compute the value function everywhere and then check where this value function meets the reward function to have the exercise boundary. The exercise boundary, which comes like the present, an aside gift that the method is giving to me, you know, I want the price of the option, and for free, I get in one single pass, I get the exercise boundary, which means that now if I want to exercise any other option, I can do it by Monte Carlo simulation if I don't want to recompute a linear program. Okay. So the original motivation was to study multiple exercises, and I developed this linear programming method to tackle this multiple exercise problem. And there are things that are okay and things that are still not okay yet. Okay, so it's having p stopping time, I can put that in one-to-one correspondence with p measures on space-time. That's easy. Replacing this constraint that one stopping time has to be smaller than the next one can be written with linear constraints on the corresponding measures. This refraction period is a problem. I would be lying to you telling you that I know how to solve that. I have a sufficient condition, so I can write constraints that are linear, but the set is a little bit too big. Okay. So what is happening is that the first numerical result that we have is that it looks like the prices that we find are correct. The last exercise boundary, which is indeed the exercise boundary of the American option with one exercise, is very sharp. For the other one, they are thick. So, and I claim that this is due to the fact that I cannot write this with linear constraint exactly. Okay. But once this little technical problem is, I mean, I don't know if it's a little technical problem, it's a major roadblock, I don't know. But once this is resolved, I'm sure that this method will be much more competitive than all the other methods that have been implemented for multiple options if you look for the exact value. Of course, you know, there are bounds, upper bounds, and lower bounds, like the one of Ben Hemley, that can be computed relatively fast, but they're simply upper and lower bound. And, you know, in many cases, you may not be happy with bounds. This, as long as you're willing to take the error of the approximation, once you've done the discretization in time and space, there's no more error. You compute the exact value, and you get the exercise boundary essentially for free. The conclusion is that this is very promising, but the bottom line for me is that with tools that have been developed by the probabilist 20, 30 years ago, which were completely forgotten, which are absolutely not taught anywhere now in our graduate program, this theory of Markov processes and potential theory of Markov processes, this was an exciting problem in the 70s. Nobody cares about it anymore. But it seems that you can reformulate a very practical problem, pricing an American option, computing an exercise boundary, an optimal exercise boundary, using this theorem as a totally different problem. So you connect two optimization field through an abstract theory of Markov processes. I found that amazing. But, you know, when you get older, you get amazed by many things that are not that great. All right, thank you very much.